This is Comics Therapy, episode 32. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from February 26th, 2014. Hawkeye number 15 and The Wake number 6. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and this week on the couch, we talk with writer Kel Simons. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Hey, this is Matt Baum from The Two-Headed Nerd. And I'm calling in with my favorite guilty pleasure character for my nerd confession. Mine is a guy named Buford Hollis. Buford was a mutant who went by the name of Razorback. And Razorback was first introduced in, I think it was Spectacular Spider-Man. He was a trucker, and he was a big, strong dude. He had mutant power, and I'm not making this up, he had a mutant power to drive any vehicle. He named all of his trucks Big Pig, and eventually ended up driving a space truck called Big Pig 3. That's where I met him, was in the pages of Sensational She-Hulk, which was one of my favorite comics when I was growing up. Razorback was my favorite because he wore a pig costume. He had like a big pig head on his head, and it was electrically charged. He was like, they just randomly assigned him powers. He's one of the most ridiculous characters out there. I totally love him. Razorback. That is my nerd confession. I love you guys. Even more.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is all your fault. Or my fault, if you ask Aaron.
Your fault.
Yeah. So there really isn't a theme, other than this little crowdsourcing experiment where we asked you all to decide which books we should talk about.
Your fault.
Uh-huh. I could try to force some over-analytical bullshit down your throats, but that's all it would be. The truth is, the only thing linking Hawkeye and The Wake to one another is the fact that many of you managed to vote legitimately for two of my traditionally favorite books. So really, I think the lesson for everyone, mostly Aaron, is that you like me. You really like me. And left to your own devices, you'll pick my side every time. Thank you. You made good choices this week, Internet. I'm proud of you. Let's talk about some comics.
Really? That's the takeaway? Not that it's like two of the most popular books out right now?
No. No, that has nothing to do with it.
Okay, it's because people like you.
Because people like me.
Wow, you've really got an ego.
Uh-huh. You should keep that in mind. Perhaps we'll reveal an alternative theme for the week, Aaron. Foreshadowing.
My guilty pleasure hero would be Howard the Duck. Growing up in a small, crappy city in the 70s, Howard's adventures in the big city of Cleveland really spoke to me, you know. Finally, a middle-class guy in a world he didn't understand, and as a kid in most elderly neighborhoods, I could relate. Thanks! Vote Howard!
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt was suggested by listener Corey Fryer, so you can blame him. Who wants to know what your favorite guilty pleasure character, hero, or villain is? You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. Of course, the show account is at Comics Therapy. Aaron runs that account. You all know that, right? So it's extra snarky, mostly at my expense. Yeah. Aaron, how was your week?
Good. You know, we both have access to that account.
Do we really?
Well, in theory, I have to approve the login request for you, but you could post something if you wanted.
I would have to ask for access. You would have to approve it, and then I could post it.
Yes, but technically, you know, we share that account.
Yeah. Hands up who thinks that Aaron would grant me access to that account so that I could post to the account.
Well, hands up for anyone who follows you on Twitter. Do they really want to see you tweet from that account?
No. Not at all.
Nope. How was my week? It was fine. You know, we got a Godzilla trailer. That was pretty cool.
I haven't seen it.
Well, it's good.
Okay.
I bought comic books and I read a lot of comic books.
It's pretty standard for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm consistent, if anything.
You are.
Yeah. I read 36 comics on Wednesday.
That's absurd.
Yeah, no, I was going for 40.
Oh, but still higher than 30.
Well, six of them were, no, five of them were digital. One was actually something from the week before.
Oh,
But still, it's a total.
Okay.
It was a good week. Good week for comics. Okay week for everything else.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
Any updates about family, dog, work, anything for the good of the order?
Dogs are well. Like, you can't really tell that Roxy has cancer or anything like that. She's peppy and going on her walks and barking around the house and has a good appetite. So can't really complain too much there. Kids are not sick and full of energy and life and sucking it from us. Yeah, sucking it out of ours. So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a standard. It's a standard suburban life, I guess.
You're adorable.
Yeah.
I actually can't make too much fun because I've sort of settled into a routine myself, which has been somewhat unusual. But I've been teaching for 5 weeks now. So I teach during the day. I pick Avi up from school. We do whatever afternoon activity he has, if applicable. I make dinner. I put him to bed. And then I watch TV. It's pretty normal.
Yeah, that sounds very normal.
Yeah.
I mean, shouldn't life kind of be normal and routine when you have kids?
I don't know. Mine hasn't been. Like I said, it's been fairly chaotic. So I'm reveling in this, but I'm still, I guess, a little bit. It has taken some getting used to know exactly what I am going to be doing at any given time and where I'm going to be and so on and so forth.
Keeping a schedule, showing up for your podcast on time.
That has nothing to do with anything.
I'm not saying anything. I'm just putting it out there.
But I've been watching a lot of really good television, which is also a fairly normal. I don't think it's necessarily exclusively suburban at all, but it's a fairly normal, like, adult thing to do.
Yeah, but I would say no matter how chaotic your life was, that always seems to be a part of it.
No. This yeah. is, really?
Yeah, you've always, as long as I have known you, you always seem to have scheduled TV time or you're watching a movie or TV shows. That seems like a pretty constant in your life.
That's so fascinating since I have giant holes in my like TV mastery. I mean, like huge, huge absences, just like my like pitiful movie awareness. Huge holes of television, relatively recent television, that I have just completely missed the boat on.
I think that's okay. I think that's the way life is now. Like, there... You know, it's different than it was 15 years ago. The invention of the DVR changed at least our generation's TV experience.
Sure, sure. But I think even access, like instant access is what, I guess the DVR is just another variation of that. But, you know, like Rod and I burned through House of Cards, like both seasons in, I don't know, 5 days. Like it was too much. By the end, I was done. I was super done with all the characters. I was super done with like the intensity of the storyline. And like,
yeah, see, that's what happened with gears. That's what happened with Breaking Bad with me. Like I watched like two seasons or a season and a half in, you know, 2 days or whatever. And I'm like, I can't watch any more of this. I just can't watch this show anymore. It's too intense. Like I don't feel good at all. Like, you know, so
I haven't seen it yet. That's another one on my list of things that I missed out on that I should probably watch at some point.
But yeah, it's weird that kind of stuff doesn't bother you.
What do you mean?
Well, I guess House of Cards doesn't really count because there's not much sort of like soul-crushing drama.
Are you kidding?
But it's different.
Are you done with the second season?
No, I'm on the third episode right now.
Okay, we can talk when you're done.
Okay. But like Breaking Bad, especially like that first season and a half, I'm like, this is good. You know, like there are TV shows and this applies to books too that are so good, but they're not fun to read.
I agree. I have a bunch of favorite books that I haven't reread.
Yeah. But there's stuff it's like, I want to know what happens, but I don't want to have the experience of watching it. I almost just want to read recaps or something. I'll find out what happens in the story.
Completely understand. I feel that way actually quite a bit about just the process of absorbing media. And that's something that, I guess you're right. I've been watching more television and watching more movies over the past several months than I had for years beforehand. And I've like learned to appreciate watching and consuming stories in that way, or like relearned, because I had had some difficulty with it. It's always been something that I couldn't focus enough on just watching. Mm-hmm. And I know you made fun of me for that last week, but like legitimately, it has been something that I'd struggled with because I couldn't absorb myself enough in the story. And so I would like get distracted. I would lose a thread of the storyline. Then I wouldn't know what was happening. Then I wasn't paying attention because I didn't know what was happening. And like, it's stupid, but I've had to like train myself to watch and I'm much better at it now. But there are still times that I'm seeing something and I'm like, ah, can I just skip to the end as if I had consumed it all, and then I can just move on and I've like had that experience, but I don't actually have to experience it myself.
It's a sad state of affairs.
Shut up.
Well, I don't know. It definitely denotes just the way, I don't know if it's good or bad, but how society and how our brains are changing. You know, life used to be very boring.
We just recounted the fact that our lives are pretty fucking boring right now.
Yeah, okay, but by modern standards, I don't think my life's boring. I think my life's routine, but that's different than boring.
Okay.
You know? So, like I like routines, and there's no excuse to be bored because there is access to unlimited amounts of entertainment. The problem is there's too much entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what I was listening to or, you know, this is the problem. There's too much stuff. But there was something talking about, like, this too much choice and how, you know, we really need less choices in our life.
Fewer.
Because when you have too much choice, you can't decide on anything. So, yeah, we have too much choice. I just want somebody to tell me what to do.
You should be watching True Detective.
I already am.
Okay. You should finish House of Cards.
I'm working on that.
That's all I got for you right now.
Yeah, I think I'm doing okay on my own with comic books. Although, I guess maybe it would be better if somebody told me, here's the series you're going to read.
Yeah, I don't think that you are a beacon in the dark of making good choices with comic books.
I don't think I read anything that's not good.
Okay.
You know, I just read the good comic books.
There's just a lot, and it's difficult for you to pare down.
It is, but I've done that a little bit.
Okay.
It's a big ball, but it used to be bigger. You know? So, I don't know, you want to talk about some of them, I guess?
I guess.
Okay, let's do that.
Each week I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, or whatever. Potentially one new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing. Who knows? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you going to give me a hint?
No, you can hear about it in 2 seconds.
Okay, go.
We're going to talk this week about number one from Box Brown and Retrofit Press.
Okay.
So I signed up for the 1-year Retrofit subscription last month, and I got my first 2 books because I got January's book and February's book in the mail, and they'll send you 1 book a month for 12 months.
Excellent.
So I actually read the 2 of them, but I guess I'll just highlight 1 of them. Box Brown is an independent comic book creator. It really kind of highlights the difference in comics out there between something that might be superhero or sci-fi and the kind of work he does, which I would say is more reflections of life, if I had to kind of describe it.
Okay.
So this is just another one of those comics. Like, it's hard to say, like, well, what are his comics about? They're just kind of about life and people and the... It's just very entertaining and well done and insightful and usually pretty kind of funny and absurdist and... So, yeah, this is just another one of those. He's got a new book coming out in a few months, Andre the Giant. It's like a, you know, it's a biography of Andre the Giant that looks pretty great. So I'm excited to hear that.
I don't remember the publisher on that one.
It's First Second.
Okay, right.
Hopefully we'll... I'm excited to read that. I don't know if we'll talk about it on the show, but... Yeah, he's... it's just something worth for... I wanted to highlight it because a lot of people don't... see these kind of small press books, and I think they're missing out. You know, they're usually a little more expensive, but I think the content you get is well worth it, and you're supporting someone usually directly. Mm-hmm. For really good comic books.
I feel so strongly that your message here was important that I let you talk over the buzzer.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you don't blow everyone's ear out.
I didn't last week, and it's important to note that there were at least 2 comments about the fact that the buzzer was too quiet, so fuck you.
Well, that just means you're a bad audio engineer who insists upon doing all the editing.
Really? We're going to do that?
I didn't say anything.
Uh-huh.
I'm just highlighting the facts. Mm-hmm. Why are you so combative today?
I'm not. not. I was actually in a really good mood this morning.
I'm kidding. And I told myself too earlier, I'm like, I'm not gonna be too mean to Andrea.
You did? Did you have like a little routine in front of the mirror? Like Stuart Smalley style?
Yeah, she's good enough. She's smart enough. And gosh darn it, some people like her.
A lot of people. Look at the books we're talking about.
I know. Look at all those votes for you. I didn't know it was a me against you kind of thing.
Aaron, everything that we do is a me against you kind of thing.
I guess so. I shouldn't try to fool myself, huh?
Yeah, let's talk about the music this week. Oh, better yet, let's not. Let's talk about comics.
Let's talk about comics. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of the team. Everything is
awesome when we live in our dream. Hello, fellow comics therapy wage slaves. I'm Keith Silva, at Keith PM Silva on Twitter, and at Comics Bulletin for way, way more than 140 characters of Silva S. Ness. First off, I take offense to this prompt. If one takes pleasure in a thing, it's not guilty. I say, hawk Hawkeye, and wave your robot ROM arms around like you just don't care. Embrace magic with all her magic-y goodness. But okay, I'll play along. My choice is a long-distance dedication to the comic book Jesus, Jason Sachs, publisher of Comics Bulletin. In comics, there is no greater hero and villain than Dave Sim. Continuity coppers. Yes, Sim is the creator, artist, and writer of Cerebus. And, like any truly great criminal of that sort, he wrote himself into his own story. So to hell with ya. Sim's attitudes towards women are unacceptable and deplorable. If you've ever thought, nobody really thinks women are soulless succubuses, yeah, they do. Dave Sim does. So that about covers the villain end of things. At least, Sim wears his ignorance and his opinion on his chest, like a target. Sim created Cerebus and developed the blueprint for what we call creator-owned comics. For this alone, he's on the Mount Rushmore of independent self-publishing. Thanks to Klaus Janson for pointing out in last week's Comics Therapy episode the difference between a company like Image that fosters creator-owned content and the Michael Fifes and Lucy Bellwoods of the world who are doing it on their own. There is nothing quite like Cerebus. Few characters are more lovable and harder to love. Cerebus, like his creator, is a jerk, a tyrant, and a straight-up charmer. He's also the most human aardvark you will ever read about. His faults are our faults. His joys and triumphs are the same as ours. Read High Society. Read it and try not to read the next volume, and the one after that, and the one after that. You can probably skip issue 186. Or don't. And you shouldn't, because the unvarnished truth about Cerebus is this. Cerebus is life, with all its ups, its downs, its ugliness, and its great, great beauty. Everything is awesome.
Our first book this week is Hawkeye number 15, written by Matthew Frickman, otherwise known as Matt Fraction, with art by David Aja and colors by Matthew Hollingsworth. Chris, oh, come on.
Eliopoulos.
I know. I choke on that name, but I know it. Okay. Chris Eliopoulos did the lettering. Hawkeye is published by Marvel Comics.
Okay. So this is the long-awaited number 15, even though number 16 is already out. We are finally back finding out what's going on with Clint Barton and his brother Barney. This storyline is pulling some threads together that had been set way back in the first couple of issues with Clint and the tracksuit mafia, the bros that he's been battling in his and around his apartment building. And we're finally starting to see some of the consequences of the rash actions that he took that have resulted in quite a bit of turmoil in his immediate life and, like, the deaths of friends and colleagues, and it's, you know, it's kind of a mess. So we're really at close to Clint's lowest point in at least this particular solo book, and it doesn't look like it's going to get better anytime soon.
Yeah. So Okay, well, tell me how you're feeling about Hawkeye.
No way, man. I want you to go first.
Well, no, okay. I can talk about it. It's fine. I still love this book, and I'll tell you why.
That's what I want to hear.
Okay. I was not expecting the ha-ha, funny, aw, puppy dog eyes book to last forever.
Sure.
Because that was starting to wear a little thin for me.
Sure.
Like, I think this is the turning point for that, I'm hoping.
Okay.
Like, the humor still needs to be there, but it also needs to change a little bit of the tone. Like,
do you think it's the darkness that I'm having a problem with?
Yeah, I think so.
No, absolutely not. I totally agree with you that the stakes need to be higher, that the intensity needs to be greater, that the consequences need to be on the table. What I'm having an issue with right now is that somewhere along the line, Clint Barton has gone from being a loner to a loser. He's not an idiot. He's never been an idiot. He's self-taught. He's absolutely brilliant in terms of marksmanship and strategy. I mean, he builds all of his own custom arrows, and we're having him walk down the street unable to tie a bow on his pants. Are you kidding me?
Right.
I feel like...
Yeah, he didn't drink paint or something.
Right. I feel like the humor is now at his expense. And so instead of relating to him and kind of seeing how he's brought this all on himself, he made poor choices. He was way too arrogant with the way that he handled the situation and has cost lives and has to deal with that. But instead, like, we've removed him from the picture. It's not about Clint Barton anymore. It's about this kind of strange, shadow of him who no longer really has, like, responsibility for his choices because he's too incompetent.
Why am I on the show still?
What do you mean?
I don't feel like I have good insights anymore. I feel like I drank paint or something.
You're just tired.
I guess maybe that's what it is.
Wait, does that mean that you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think you are right, and that is a big flaw in this book. That the quest for humor... And the easy, so by what you're saying, and this is now kind of changing the perspective, but you make him to be the kind of the idiot in a way, who will at the end of the day, he'll triumph, you know, because he's Hawkeye or something.
Right. But at this point he's triumphing over himself.
Yes. So, well,
but in the wrong
so
way.
Hang on.
Okay.
So, cause now it's easy to derail my brain cause it's not working apparently.
Because of the paint that you drank.
I guess so. So, okay. So, he'll, you know, because it's comics, et cetera, et cetera, and we want the humor, but, okay, it's easy to have the funny, the bumbling idiot, and then, boom, at the end, you have this big emotional cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
That, I guess, maybe, it, like, with what you say, that's a pretty lazy way to do a book.
Yeah. Because bumbling is exactly what he is right now, and bumbling has not been the way that he has been portrayed in the past. I can deal with Clint Barton making bad life choices because that's why I kind of love him. He's terrible about taking care of himself, but not so much in that he...
would make also very bad tactical mistakes.
Absolutely. I think that that's what it comes back to.
That he let's just spoil it because we need to talk about this issue.
Okay.
So if you haven't read it, we're going to talk about whatever. You already got the warning.
Welcome to the internet.
Right. Exactly. So right. So he wouldn't charge upstairs with an assassin in the building, turn a blind corner, and you know, and be whatever happened to him taken out.
He's so blinded by the need to do good, and that's fine. That fits in with his constant series of redemption arcs that his entire character is based around.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, people have died.
Well, he also needs to do good, but as an Avenger, it doesn't mean this is Clint Barton when he's not an Avenger. It means he turns off the part of his brain that knows how to be a tactician and be a human without superpowers who is on a superpower team and somehow survives.
But the fact that people have died should have been the trigger for him to, like, completely abandon ship. That the focus should have been getting the rest of the people in the building out and safe, reestablishing them elsewhere, reestablishing what his priorities were. Like, as a tactician, he's made 17 different errors. And that's the problem that I have.
Yeah.
And the way that we're seeing that, like, in subtle ways is, you know, he can't fucking tie his belt. He can't, what was it a couple of issues ago where he was calling Mockingbird for help with something? Oh, like a spelling word? Are you kidding? That just reduces him way, 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 way down. And yeah, it's a cheap laugh, but it really does a disservice to the story, because mm-hmm. now suddenly he's in this really like intense moment and there's a huge cliffhanger at the end and oh my goodness, what's going to happen? Well, but it's not him anymore. And that's just a weird, it puts us in a really weird position as readers. We readers who are familiar with the character, like, how are we supposed to care about this kind of bubbling idiot who has, like, the whole time been doing this to himself?
Hmm. All right. Well, I don't like this book anymore.
I don't mean it like that. I like the book quite a bit, and there's absolutely no denying that any time that David Aja is drawing, it's masterful.
That's the thing, that it's relying on beautiful art and cheap laughs to tell a weaker character story.
But do you also acknowledge that the same thing is sort of happening with Kate?
Oh, yeah. But she's also not, I would say she's not as an important as a character or have enough background to where you could kind of fudge that. Like, you can make her a dumb kid because she's 19.
Still, it's a departure from the confidence that she showed before. And the one thing that both of them had was confidence. I mean, we were joking earlier when I told you that the real theme of the show is hubris, and that both Clint and Kate have a little bit of, not even a little, quite a bit of arrogance. They're aware of their strengths, and Clint especially has fought for that. He's fought for leadership roles because he's confident in his abilities. We're not seeing that right now, and it's weird.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
You know, sometimes I read comics. Sometimes I get it right.
Yeah, maybe I need to read less comics so I can kind of think about them more.
Oh my God. Fewer. If there's, you know, what? Things to count, it's fewer. If there are piles of stuff, it's less.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Are you serious?
No, I do. Are we going to be grammar Nazis now? You've been teaching too long. That's the problem.
I have. Can you tell? It's like the entire way that I approach speaking to a fellow human has shifted over the past several weeks.
No kidding.
I need to calm the fuck down.
Are you going to put, you know, at least you used a curse word.
Right. I don't do that in school, by the way. I don't do that with my students. I just want to make that super clear.
Good.
Does it matter how old they are? Well, no, that's a lie. If they're in college, I've definitely loosened up a little bit with the way that I speak with them. But younger kids, I'm a good teacher. Okay, let's move on.
I believe you. I believe you teach gooder
yeah.
than most people.
Dude, I just schooled you on Hawkeye, so really.
No, that's great. Let's school me on the next one.
Hi, guys. Jason Sachs here at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. As you know, I am the publisher and owner of Comics Bulletin. And as such, I get reviews and stuff from a bunch of different critics and friends who enjoy posting stuff to my site. One of my favorite former writers is a guy named Ray Tate. Ray was a very opinionated dude, particularly about a certain few subjects, one of which was Batgirl, and the other of which was Tigra. Ray would obsess about Tigra. Any comic that featured Tigra, at least as the joke went, and treated her well, was a 5-star comic in Ray's world. He would often talk about how artists would draw the suppleness of her fur and the beauty of her eyes, the fantastic way that she filled out her bikini suit, and the beautiful patterns that they would draw her fur with, stuff like that. It was an interesting experience running that kind of stuff. Even when he was doing this work for my site, it became just so fun to kind of see the way he would appreciate Tigra comics based on his perception of her. And, you know, since then, that character's been a guilty pleasure of mine. Never really especially liked her, but the fact that he enjoyed her so much and so deeply kind of was cool and weird and interesting all at the same time. Made her a very special kind of pleasure. Thanks, guys. See you later. Bye.
Our second book is The Wake Number 6, written by Scott Snyder, with art by Sean Murphy and colors by Matt Hollingsworth. Lettering is by Jared K. Fletcher. The Wake is published by Vertigo Comics.
So I reread the first 5 before I read number 6. Did you also do that?
No.
No, of course not. I read 36 books.
Right.
Well.
Also, I remember what I read.
Okay.
I don't watch 25 hours of TV in a day. I can retain storylines.
Those two things are unrelated, although I will acknowledge that I don't always retain the story. But often I read with a higher level of comprehension than my co-hosts. Anyway, this new issue kind of circles back to what was introduced in the very first issue, which is that there are two stories happening in The Wake. There is what happened in 2014 when the Mer people, really, are we calling them that? And the humans are first interacting in the modern day. And then the ramifications of that interaction 200 years in the future. So we've laid the groundwork for the second part of the story, this second arc, which starts with issue number 6. It's not exactly a brand new character. We did see her before. It's just this is the first time that we're really getting to know her and get a closer look at what the state of things is at this point in the future. At the end of the 5th issue, we get really kind of the actual conflict between the humans and the merfolk. God, I just wish that there was a better word for it, because it just reduces it to some kind of silly fantasy creature. And that's actually one thing that I've felt that this book has stayed above. So
yeah,
it's fine. I know it's just semantics, but anyway. So it looks like we're going to be hanging out in the future for a bit, if not the remainder of this 10-issue miniseries. And seeing how our humans can actually hold their own against the creatures from the sea.
Yeah, so sweet.
Really?
At the end, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. You want to move on?
Tell me how you feel about the book, Aaron.
I love this book.
But why?
Well, I like merfolk. And I love the future.
Okay, done and done.
Enough said. No, okay, so this new arc, I like the end of number 5, when it skipped to the future, mm-hmm. It's like, to me, that is, it's just like, it's just another thing I can't be objective about. It's like, yes, future post-apocalyptic, you know, world that we're going to get to explore. Mm-hmm. Really liked, you know, the first 5, because mm-hmm. it felt very formulaic horror. In a way, you know, like a Deep Blue Sea or the Abyss, yeah, or something like that.
Especially with the addition of the hallucinogenic venom.
Yeah.
So there was this twisting of awareness and reality. Yeah, I agree. Those
things, right. I mean, to me, it's like,
especially, are freaky.
Right. To me, it's like, cool, this is a good treatment for the movie we're going to see in 4 years. You know, it's like, it's fine. It's good. I love the art. You know, it's a good story. It's fine. It's a good read. And then the end of number 5, it's like, whoa, okay, now we're getting a completely different book. Mm-hmm. And a new society with rules you can completely make up. Mm-hmm. You know, an enemy we're familiar with, but has been evolving as well. Mm-hmm. And humans against themselves and humans against the mer creatures.
Yeah.
The fishmen.
Yeah.
And how you survive in that post-crash, you know, ecologically crash society. It also kind of brings up a lot of things that are still poignant and applicable to our current world, whether, you know, you have a fantastical kind of occurrence. But I think it's fun to explore what will happen when the ice caps melt and the coastlines change and the world changes with it.
Well, in that regard, though, I mean, we've talked about The Massive before, and I think that that book is closer to a realistic,
yeah,
still fantastical, but more realistic view of a series of catastrophic events and then, like, the way that, right, society responds.
Yeah.
I think that when you have, like, monster creatures from the ocean, that changes everybody's perspective in this post-apocalyptic world. Mm-hmm. And I think the point that you just made about like man versus man, in addition to man versus merfolk, is not something that I was expecting. And so when we get that taste of the government oversight and the government kind of extreme cracking down on information seeking and information possession, that is like another layer that I'm pretty intrigued by that's happening that we were first introduced to in this current issue.
Yeah. There's a lot. You know what? Scott Snyder's a pretty good writer.
Yeah. You know, maybe he should try this comic book thing out a bit. I do think that, that arrogance, though, of individual characters and of like humanity as a whole, that belief that you've got it all taken care of for the greater good, and then P.S. you super don't and everything's going to fail, is actually the through line between these two books. And we have kind of a system of disasters set in place by Clint. We have a system of disasters set in place by the scientists and the government with the ghost rig in the wake. Not to say that the I can't stand merfolk. It just sounds so dumb to me. But anyway,
fish friends.
You know, not to say that they wouldn't have ultimately attacked the humans if that rig hadn't been built. But still, we see the direct relationship between the human arrogance of the way that we as a society have treated the ocean and the kind of ocean's response or this other creature's response to that intrusion.
Well, can I ask one thing, though? And I think it's this goes back to that storytelling element. So, you know, 90% chance our protagonist saves the day. You know,
who is our protagonist at this point? Is it Lee or is it Leeward?
I forget character names now. The girl we're following throughout this issue.
Okay, so Leeward, our 200 years later, clearly related because, oh, that subtle eyedrop moment.
Yes. So both of them, both of these female protagonists, heroes, will save the day, you know?
For some capacity, sure.
Right. But is that... You know, we want redemption stories. We always need that. Otherwise, we feel incomplete. But is that an old way of writing stories at this point? Like, realistically, if these mayor whatever, I'm trying to think of other adjectives, but I think I'm tapped out now. Yeah, fish friends. If the fish friends were capable of sinking the cities, sinking the coastlines, et cetera, et cetera, humanity wouldn't survive. You know?
Right.
But in the end of this story, humanity probably will survive.
I don't know. I don't think that Snyder is necessarily known for...
I can't think of one that doesn't have their redemption at the end.
You're right.
But that's the way you tell a story.
That's the way that you tell a story where the human is the most important character, though.
Right. Well, humans are always the most important characters. Look at any kind of sci-fi. Humans are always the center of... whatever galactic conflict or, you know, humanity has something unique and special about it than anything else in the universe. But
there were moments in the first arc where the creatures were painted sympathetically, not for an extended amount of time. And they certainly didn't respond to the humans in the rig in any kind of sympathetic way. I mean, it was pretty antagonistic, but still there was at least... Lee had, I don't know, I guess I'm expecting some attempt at communication. There's a line dropped in this issue about men mating with merfolk. I don't know if you noticed that, because sometimes you read so fast you don't pick up on these things.
That's true. I'm a very fast reader.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like there is a possibility, maybe the redemption arc, that we are now delving like way into predictive territory, and I usually try to avoid that. But maybe it's not just about the humans. Maybe it's about both species. If we've established that they have a shared ancestor, maybe it's more about like circling back and finding what we had lost.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
I can't ever tell if you think that that's a good suggestion, if you are processing because I'm fucking brilliant, or if you're like, yeah, Andrew, whatever, are you done? Can I talk now?
Yeah, I like to keep you guessing. I can't, you know, it keeps the spice in the relationship.
A That's what we're going for.
Sure. But to go back to that, then let's take it out of this story. And I'm just talking about stories in general.
Okay.
How the formula for stories that we don't seem to get bored with is that humanity triumphs. There's the hero. The hero overcomes both the bad people and whatever the adversity is and saves, you know, humans, quote unquote. Or humans are the key to redemption.
I'm pretty intrigued by the qualifier you put on that. Because the idea of not getting bored with that structure, I don't think is accurate at all. Look at some of the books that we've talked about most recently, and even some of the prose that we've brought into it. I mean, that's the anti-resolution is the whole point of a book like Cat's Cradle, or any sort of moment where at the very end, there's no hope for the humans. Look at Planet of the Apes. Look at some of these iconic examples that take that hubris and that arrogance of the human race and turns it around and uses it against us in toto. And so the end is the end of the humans.
But I would say overall, those stories are fewer than the triumph stories.
That's why they're effective.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm thinking back, like, probably my favorite novel is 1984.
Okay.
Which has a pretty bummer ending.
Sure. A short story like Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut. Are you familiar with it?
Yes.
So, super short, and it's available for free on the internet if you haven't read it.
Well, but everything's available for free on the internet.
I mean, legitimately free, not pirated.
Oh, okay.
Because it is a very short example of that kind of situation where, like, the hero who you should root for because he is exceptional doesn't win at the end. And, like, it's not an example of, like, all of humanity failing, but it's an example of free humanity failing, which it arguably is worse. I think that there are more examples of that than you're giving credit to. And
maybe.
I think that that's why they are remarkable. So when you have the potential for something, and I don't want to turn it into just like prediction with The Wake specifically, so let's keep it broad. But when you have the potential for not just that protagonist getting what she wants, working hard and like overcoming adversity and, you know, the way that it always is, that's what makes it exciting for me as a reader.
Yeah, I agree. At the same time, like, I want to be a hypocrite to myself too, because I like to see, I like to see success.
Sure.
I want that, you know, sometimes I don't want to be bummed out all the time.
I am a very good hypocrite. Come on.
No, you're the best.
Redemption. Thanks. I am the best.
Yes.
I like redemption arcs. Absolutely. I'm just saying that there is room for a more sophisticated take on things that doesn't put the generic human protagonist, or even the exceptional human protagonist, or even that tragic hero, like Greek archetypical flawed hero at the center, always getting what he or she wants.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk to a exceptional human?
Nice segue.
Come on, that was better than most weeks.
Yeah, only because I threw out a word for you.
Well, that's why we're a great team. That's why we'll triumph and be successful.
Absolutely. Just as long as everybody acknowledges that I am far more liked than the other guy.
That's fine. I still run the Twitter account.
It's good to have goals, Myers.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk to Cal Simons.
Let's do it.
Hey, Andrea and Aaron. Tom Zimmer here, also known as Victor Von Zoom, on the social media networks, calling in with this week's nerd confession on what is your favorite guilty pleasure. First of all, you should know, I am a hard-hitting, tough guy, love guns, blowing shit up, punching supervillains in the face. I like it gritty and real. Smoke haze, whiskey ring stains, and emotionally broken friends. In my alpha male world, I don't mind complex and struggling relationships, but probably prefer just reckless carnal desires. And what I read reflects my super badass nihilistic personality. So please, don't tell anyone that I am in hot with Lil Gotham. What a sweet, cute little gem of a book. No matter what kind of crap day I've had, or how much trouble I am in with the wife, my dogs, or my boss, this beautifully illustrated comic book brings a smile to my face that I imagine young Victor had plastered on his face reading a Plastic Man or Metal Man way back when. If you're not totally enamored with this delightful reimagining of the Bat Family, then you're just a big old meanie. Thanks for listening, guys. Talk.
This week on the couch, we welcome writer Kel Simons. Kel is a writer and producer. He wrote the miniseries I Love Trouble, published by Image Comics, and his brand new series, Mercenary C, also from Image, debuted February 12th of this year. Thanks for joining us, Kel.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kel, we always start with a rundown of current and upcoming projects, especially if you have anything on the docket that you can give us a teaser about besides Mercenary C, which obviously is what we're primarily interested in, right? Do you have any other comics in the works, or do you have projects coming up in another medium that you want to share?
Sure. I'm doing another series for Image with Nathan Stockman, who's an artist that lives in Ireland. He actually came in and did the sixth issue of I Love Trouble when the original artist and my creative partner on that, Mark Robinson, wasn't able to finish the series because he had some other commitments. So I had a really good time working with Nate and really wanted to come up with something to do with him. So I pitched Image an ongoing series. It's sort of a sci-fi fantasy hybrid in the vein of like a Conan style swords and sorcery.
Oh, wow. But with a sci-fi.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That'll sort of be peeled back as we continue with the series. But yeah, it'll look like sort of a straight up swords and sorcery thing at first. And then there'll be some interesting reveals.
So when can we expect to see that? Yeah.
I'm hoping, I've written the first five scripts and Nate is actually finishing up a couple projects. He does Antihero for, I think it's Monkey Brain Comics.
Right. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Jay Ferber. And he's just finishing up a run on that. And he thinks that he'll be able to start working on it probably next month. And just depending on how quickly he can turn this around and how quickly we're working with Paul Little, who did the colors on I Love Trouble as well. He actually introduced me to Nate. I think we're kind of aiming for end of the year if we can get it turned around that quickly.
No, that's great. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, so let's kind of talk about the past a little bit.
Okay.
So you worked in Hollywood for years.
Well, I still do, actually.
Okay.
I juggle both comics and writing for features and television.
Uh huh. So do you do more writing or production for Hollywood?
For years, I ran a production company for a producer, Mace Neufeld, who's probably best known for like the Omen movies and all the Jack Ryan films.
Okay.
So I did that for about 10 years. But I originally came out to Los Angeles to be a writer, to be a screenwriter, and went to the American Film Institute. But after a few months of graduating, I was offered this gig as an executive working for Mace and, couldn't really turn it down.
Right.
Next thing you know, I'm working there for 10 years. So, but about 6 or 7 years ago, I gave that up. I started writing full time, kind of getting back to my roots, so to speak. And it's actually in the last couple of years, it's really starting to pay off for me or pay some dividends.
When you talk about your roots, you're talking about screenwriting for film and television as opposed to comics, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, I certainly read comics, but my first love was always movies and television.
That's totally fine with us.
Okay. All right, good.
So what makes you make that jump to comics then?
It was happenstance more than anything. I'm actually friends with Eric Stevenson, the publisher of Image. And we've known each other for years. And he, kept saying, yeah, you should bring something in. And he actually brought me the idea for I Love Trouble. It was part of a sort of a larger series that he wanted to do, a shared universe of characters. and have different creators creating characters in this world. And I was like the first one he approached. He was actually doing one himself, a story in that same world. But basically what happened was mine was the first one to get fully realized, written. We had an artist, and the other characters that were being developed in this role, I guess, just never really came together. So it really just became the Felicia show. Uh-huh. Yes. And you know, and that's where I Love Trouble came from.
So was that part of, like, originally in concept, like Nowhere Men would have been part of the same kind of universe, like
It wasn't going to be shared with Nowhere Men, but it was going to be a world where people were starting to, and generally younger folks were starting to develop superpowers, but what Eric called grounded superpowers. Like, he didn't want anybody to fly or be able to shoot laser beams out of their eyes, but he wanted to have, you know, telekinesis, clairvoyance, telepathy.
We weren't going to get a reboot of the Extreme Universe or anything like that.
Yes, exactly. And what the sort of overriding principle or overriding theme of this universe was that these people who were developing powers, none of them were going to put on capes and tights and become superheroes or supervillains. Mm-hmm. They were just out for themselves and, you know, basically their own personal gain based on whatever their particular abilities were.
Yeah, I kind of found that interesting because it's a little more realistic, you know. It's sort of a more cynical approach to humans, but I think it's probably more, you know, realistic to in what would happen. Absolutely. When that kind of stuff happens. I think you see that in I Love Trouble. It's like, you know, people don't don the cape and cowl and go out and fight crime naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's an ideal that has kind of been imbued in comics, but it's probably not a reality to those sorts of
situations. Yeah, it's that with great power comes great responsibility, you know, ideal. But I think, you know, with anybody, if you've got an acumen for mathematics or music, you use those skills and abilities to carve out an existence for you where you get to showcase them. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Felicia, you know, she's a con artist and you know, low-level criminal who suddenly realizes she has the ability to teleport and ups her criminal game.
Right, wherein if it was a Marvel comic, it would have been, well, I have these abilities, I better go and fight crime now or something.
Well, yeah, her abilities are also much more, she has more parameters to work under. She has restrictions, I guess, is a better mm-hmm. way of putting it. She can't just teleport anywhere. I mean, I actually think that one of the things that grounds that development of her power is the fact that it's not limitless.
Right. She has to be able to see or visualize the area that she's going to.
Right. And so it works actually much better for her in terms of her personal gain than for any kind of greater good.
Yeah. Well, and Eric basically gave me, he had like four different characters in this universe. And one of them was a young woman discovers that she has the ability, a young woman discovers she has a superpower in the middle of a plane crash and becomes an assassin. That was sort of the one line that he gave me. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, I went back and thought about that and Felicia was born shortly thereafter.
I kind of makes me wonder with your background in TV production, TV and movies, was that sort of the idea that this sort of shared universe would start to get created and with the eventual kind of jump then to, you know, TV or movies too?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's really a comic book property. And I honestly, there's like, I don't see Hollywood responding to this particular world simply because there's a lot of similar projects already out there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And ours was a little bit darker and more cynical than what you would probably normally get from Hollywood. You know, I mean, that's always evolving and changing, but for the most part, I just thought I Love Trouble was certainly far too dark to make a transition into movies or television. And we never really wanted to do that. In fact, I kind of enjoyed the freedom of doing whatever I wanted to do with the comic and the character that I wouldn't be afforded if I were doing it as a TV series or as a movie.
Or if you're actually like you're writing this, but write this with the idea that it'll be translated to a script down the road if everything goes right.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of really, I could see that stifling the creative process quite a bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just allowed me to sort of open up my imagination and kind of do whatever I wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah.
sense, as long as Mark was able to put it together. And I think he was able to do pretty much anything I asked him to do.
Yeah. It was really interesting in that way. And I really liked how his art style kind of brought that character to life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, he's got some real talent. I mean, he's a really special talent.
Let me ask you kind of about your writing process and what it's like. It seems like it'd be much different writing for TV or movies than it is for comics, but maybe I'm wrong. Is there a different kind of research process? Is there a different kind of writing process when you're writing comics now as opposed to doing TV or movies?
No, I mean, storytelling is storytelling. Hmm. It all is basically the same skill set. There are, for lack of a better word, different formats that you have to put these stories in, and there are certain things you can and can't do. For instance, I mean, I think writing comics is a much more metered style of storytelling. I mean, you have 22 pages, you have 24 pages, you have 5, maybe 7 panels on a page that you can tell a story. And I always kind of like to, as soon as you turn the page, either you're turning the page and there's a reveal or a surprise, or you're transition to a different scene too. So it's different in that regard, but I don't think that you can distinguish between my writing for scripts for television or film from the writing that I do for comics.
Do you storyboard? Do you visualize it at all? Like, it seems like with comics, it seems like it would lend itself that way.
I outline, I have sort of broad strokes that I want each story, each issue to deal with. And I sort of know where the issue is going to begin and end. And there are scenes that I want to get to, but, aside from a very basic outlining, I certainly don't have any storyboarding skills. Unless you want to see like some stick figures on an index card.
Well, that's kind of how I always envisioned it, especially if the writer isn't necessarily an artist. It seems like you have a bunch of scribbles that would kind of break it down. But it probably depends on what kind of learner and visualizer you are, I guess, as a creator.
I'd rather just, rather than wasting the time with the really crappy drawings, I'd rather just put it on the page as prose or as scripted dialogue, what have you.
And then do you find that the artists you're working with come back to you with questions or clarifications? Or do you usually?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, for the most part, though, I haven't had any real problems with the scripts. I mean, I've been told I write very cinematically, but nobody's ever said, oh, this is an issue. In fact, I just sort of assume, in a sense, that maybe a lot of writers approach it the same way. That there is a cinematic style to the way people write. In fact, I probably get into more almost like a director might in the terms of the language that I use. I'll use a close-up here, pullback, medium shot, aerial shot. I would never actually write any of that in a screenplay. It's not my job as the writer of a screenplay, because there's a director of photography, there's a director, there's a whole host of crew members that's their responsibility. And you're kind of wasting your time, and the whomever is going to be reading it, you're bogging them down with unnecessary details that you don't really have a lot of control over. But with a script for a comic book, I have complete control in that regard.
That's really interesting, because you're talking about just the difference in the division of labor and the scale and scope of the project. So it actually doesn't surprise me at all that you would approach it with your background in film and communicate to an individual artist in that way. It's not, I will tell you, just from like our limited pool of who we've talked to over the past, however many months, that's not necessarily the way that every writer, and I think it's absolutely a product of your own experiences in another industry. So I think there's nothing bad about it. It's obviously working really well in terms of how you're communicating.
No one has scolded me.
Yeah, that's not surprising. I think that does translate, though. Looking at your camera angles, looking at the point of view of the character moments, especially like the beats as they are revealing information about themselves and kind of going through the process of discovery in Felicia's case, and what we're going to hopefully start to see with Jack in Mercenary Sea. I think that
it's not at all surprising to me that you have had influence from your film background in the way that that is translated into two dimensions in the comics.
Yeah, you know, with Mark on I Love Trouble, he came from a background in animation. You know, he went to school to originally be an animator. Mm-hmm. And I think he worked at Pixar. So he had a cinematic background that he drew from. And mm-hmm. I think also with Matthew Reynolds on The Mercenary Sea, he and I just have a shared interest, a shorthand that deals with cinema. And I can just write, I mean, I'll mention, he's like, oh, it's like that scene in this, and he knows what I'm talking about, and he's, you know, either aping it or inspired by it or, you know, what have you. But it, again, it's part of a shorthand that I can actually put into a script. And again, that's something I could never do in a screenplay. It's like, sure. Oh yeah, it's like that shot in Citizen Kane where you're like,
I think it's very clear in Mercenary Sea, especially just from the, like the digital style of the art. Mm-hmm. Speaks very much to kind of a broad like digital cinema approach it's actually an interesting juxtaposition with the time that the story is set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has a very kind of slick modern feel, yet it's not, unlike I Love Trouble, it's not set now.
Right, it's all done on computers, but set in a pre-computer age.
Right. Well, so let's actually talk a little bit about the tone of the difference in tone, I guess, between I Love Trouble and Mercenary Sea, but just more from a, like a broader genre approach.
Okay. Well, I mean,
because I'm curious, like,
well, I was going to say, like, well, the Mercenary Sea is clearly a genre story.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But it's, you know, first of all, Matthew and I basically are writing this series for ourselves and you guys get to tag along.
This
is the kind of thing that I would want to see or read as, you know, as a comic book reader.
That's actually what I'm more interested in, is if that is coming from like your personal interest, like that's really interesting to me then, reading your book, knowing, okay, this is like the kind of story that Kel gets into and like he would choose to read on his own or he would choose to watch as his own.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I guess I'm sort of interested in pulling that out in comparison to I Love Trouble. Like, do you feel like now with Mercenary Sea that there is that correlation between like what you personally enjoy and then you can now share it, but you're really doing it for yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, look, I all writing I've ever done is really for myself for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm entertaining myself.
It seems like that, like not to cut you off, but it seems like that's a truer creative experience too, when you're not writing to an audience, you know, mm-hmm. where you maybe have to keep that in mind more when it comes to like TV or movies, because there's more pressures to appeal to certain demographics. There's still that in comics, but it is a creative art form. You as the creator should be telling the story you want, and the people, you know, you attract the people that want to hear that story.
Yeah, well, thank God there's no test screenings in comics. I don't have to deal with that. And it really is just for myself. In fact, and at Image, and I only have experience writing for Image, so I can't speak to the way other publishers do it. But there was a conversation I had with Eric rather early on when I was doing I Love Trouble. You know, I come from a background in Hollywood where everybody has an opinion.
Right.
And everybody feels entitled to share that opinion with the writer or the artist or whomever is, you know, in the room at the time. There are entire development staffs from production companies to studios that all deliver notes and comments and opinions on a script during the process of writing it. And I didn't get any of that. You know, even a writer for, you know, a novelist gets an editor's opinions, and you know, an editor goes through any novelist's work and manuscript and gives them notes. I didn't have any of that with Eric, and I was a little freaked out by it the first time that I experienced it, because it's like working without a net. And I said, you know, do you have any notes? And he gave me a couple of notes, but he basically said, look, this is your story to tell. We are creator owned. It's your you're the creator. You tell the story that you want to tell. We'll publish it, and you know, hopefully an audience responds to it. But it's really all on you. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of pressure to be dealing with. But it was also kind of a relief and a very freeing environment to write in.
Yeah, in a way, it's like a real-time kind of learning experience, because every series you're going to put out, you probably learn more on how to refine that, you know, that writing process and the creative process. And it probably will influence, you know, what you create in the future. But it's sort of a real-time feedback, too.
Everything that I write is, I always feel marginally better than the thing that I wrote previous to it, because I am constantly honing my skills, learning my craft. I would, you know, hopefully I'm doing this for the next 20 or 25 years, and I'm continuing to evolve as a storyteller, as an artist.
Let's talk about The Mercenary Sea for a minute, because this is the story you want to tell. Has it something you've been kicking around for a while? Is it something that's been germinating in a way? Like, what's the genesis of this story?
Well, the genesis is I came across Matthew. We were deep into production on I Love Trouble. This was, I think, summer of 2012, and the book was due to come out at the end of 2012, and my work was kind of done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the art takes many months to, you know, sometimes years to get done. And my work had been basically done for months. And I was looking for the next thing to do. And I came across Matthew's work on a website that I, you know, almost read daily, IO9.
Yeah.
And they had these, basically there was an article or a posting about Matthew, and it was these black and white images of Indiana Jones in a variety of different adventures that are not from the films.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was Indy fighting with a Nazi going over the waterfalls on a patrol boat, or Indiana Jones going into an ancient Japanese temple where there's a ninja waiting for him. And it was just really cool stuff. And I reached out to Matthew. I tracked him down off of from the article to his DeviantArt page. And I reached out to him and we started emailing back and forth. And originally all I wanted was to introduce myself and to ask him if I could get some HD, some high definition images of that art, because I thought it was really cool. I thought I'd use it as like wallpaper for my computer screen. And we just got to talking about things that we, you know, enjoyed, and certainly, you know, talked about the fact that I was writing this book for Image. And I basically said, have you ever done a comic book before? Because I really think you have a unique visual style. And he'd done some work, but certainly not on the sort of professional level that we were talking about. And so we just kept kicking around some ideas, and he's a big fan of like Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan and The Land That Time Forgot, and Savage. You know, he comes from a very pulp adventure background. He also loved G.I. Combat comics from like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And was also enamored with like the Vietnam War and jungle warfare. So we just started kicking around some ideas, and he had this idea for something he wanted to work on set against the backdrop of World War II. And I had thrown out a couple of ideas, and I, you know, had a ton of influences that I wanted to tap into, from Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is one of my favorite movies, if not my favorite film, to you know, I just love the ensemble interaction of a show like Firefly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So started kicking around a bunch of ideas, and Mercenary Sea was basically born from that. But from our shared love of things like Jaws and King Kong and The Land That Time Forgot.
It's interesting to hear how it was kind of dual influences as you kind of talked through the premise and everything that you mentioned. I recognize in the final product in bits and pieces, in a way that ultimately is very cohesive.
Yeah. With I Love Trouble, I had actually written the first couple scripts before before I'd ever even met Mark. this was something that was more given to me by Image and Eric. And then he set about, after I wrote a script that he liked, he set about trying to get me involved with a couple of different artists. And eventually we landed on Mark. So a lot of Felicia and this and the world of I Love Trouble was already in place by the time Mark came on board. And by the way, he added a lot to it. In fact, the character of Marcel, the monkey, he said he wanted Felicia to have sort of a conscience, like Jiminy Cricket, you know, which he called Little Leisha. You know, it was like supposed to be like a little Felicia, like on her shoulder, you know, commenting on stuff. And the idea of her childhood toy was already in the script. And I said, oh, well, let's make it this, you know, her imaginary friend from childhood was this stuffed monkey. And that's where that came from. But I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of that world was already sort of in place when Mark came on board. Whereas with Matthew, we had an equal share in the creation of that universe.
So I Love Trouble has a female protagonist, and it's a sort of fantastical situation.
Yeah.
Because Felicia has superpowers and she's recovering from the like trauma of the crash.
And she's kind of got some her own internal.
She's sorting out all of that. Yeah. She's sorting that all in her head, and you know, like you said, she's got this Jiminy Cricket like figure as she's dealing with this ultimately very intense personal journey. So, and I think you just mentioned that Mercenary Sea is intentionally like a more of an ensemble piece. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious though, with Jack as kind of Jack Harper as our like touchstone to that crew, are we going to see, can we expect to see that same kind of character development slash discovery arc with Mercenary C on within the backdrop of the more pulpy action like adventure type storyline?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes. I'm certainly intending to do that. I mean, on the surface, I want him to be the square-jawed leading man, you know, cutting through jungles, taking on the enemy. But beneath that, there will be sort of a quest for redemption, as well as fortune. And I want to be able to peel back some of the layers, get more, you know, explore more of his backstory. I've only hinted at it in the first issue, and this first six issues, which comprises our first story arc, we're not going to get too deep into that. But in the future, I really want to explore not just him, but all the characters on the venture. You know, I want to really explore them as to the fullest, you know?
Yeah, I think that especially given when it is set, there's a lot to tease out about what brings them all together, right? Mm-hmm. The choices that they made to lead them all into this like single, on the single path, the single journey, and then, you know, how are they then different? That was something that struck me as you could have a lot of fun with that when I was reading.
I'm hoping to. And actually the I've already started scripting, you know, the next story arc, and that story arc will be something that takes place in the character's present, but also I'm planning on it being another six issues, and each issue will start with a backstory for one of the characters and try to make that backstory organic to what's happening in the present as well.
Great.
And, you know, basically the story will be that their ghosts are coming back to haunt them. And not to give away too much, but, you know, clearly I've set up the idea that they had worked as basically mercenaries for the Chinese Navy fighting against the Japanese. Were betrayed by the Chinese admiral that had brought them together, basically. And they basically got out of that trap and stole the boat and basically went freelance in the South Seas.
I kind of feel like it's Indiana Jones meets the A-Team set in the South Pacific on a submarine.
That works too. I've not even thought of the A-Team, but I'm, yes.
Yeah.
Great.
Man, now I have the song in my head.
It's great. I love the A-Team.
Me too.
I think I need to get Mike Post to do something for us. Still around? Maybe he's dead. I hope.
Oh,
yeah, you can contact him. Yeah.
Get him to
never know.
Song for us.
Ah, yeah.
Do you Kel, do you have an interest in histories?
Specifically, like, to some degree, I suppose you're probably asking that because you want to know how much research I probably did.
Well, yes and no. I think that if you have like an organic interest in a time, you know, you might just kind of naturally gravitate toward that when you're telling the story that you want to tell, mm-hmm. and then you supplement that with research.
Well, you know, I love reading sort of the hard-boiled detective stories of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, mm-hmm. James Payne. So I like that period, the 30s and 40s.
Right.
The era of Our Greatest Generation, essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
And I love, I love a good. It's probably weird to even say that now, and probably not PC, but I love a good war story. You know, I love a good war movie of Saving Ryan, Bridge Up the River Kwai, Bridge Too Far, mm-hmm. Eagles Dare. I love that sort of that realm. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly been enamored with the era of World War II. When I was in high school, I remember reading a lot of nonfiction history books about World War II. And whenever that came around in our world history course, that was always something I gravitated towards. So to that degree, yes, this is a realm that I've always wanted to explore. But there's also part of it that is interesting to me in that it is this pre-technology era where the world hasn't been mapped yet.
Right.
You know, there's no GPS, there's no satellites, there's no computers. You can't just push a button and get information. You have to go out and find those answers, you know, mm-hmm. and it's probably just over the horizon. That's cool to me. You know, the idea that there are lost islands and things that haven't been explored to the fullest because we're still exploring. You know, we're not that far removed from the era of Here Be Monsters.
Right.
Written on the edge of a map because nobody has gone past that latitude.
It's a lovely backdrop, actually, for the kind of suspension of disbelief, like, adventure that it seems like we're heading towards with mm-hmm. just the very premise of like Lost Island.
Yes. I mean, that was a big part of it too, is like, I want to do the Skull Island version, or, island that time forgot.
So knowing that you have this kind of natural affinity for history and adventure, mm-hmm. Who from history, living or dead, I'll accept anything. who would you have dinner with?
Probably a couple of good answers for that.
Okay.
I'd love to sit down with like Orson Welles and Ed Wood
together
over steaks and cocktails at Musso and Frank's in Hollywood.
Nice.
and just talk movies. Raymond Chandler and Ian Fleming had developed like a pen pal relationship for a number of years between at the end of Chandler's career and the beginning of Fleming's. I'd love to sit down with the two of those guys and talk.
And talk about writing or talk about
whatever it is they want to talk about. and then, you know, I would love to have been like a fly on the wall or you know, just sat down at one. I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Jaws Log, which is sort of an in-depth look at the year of production that Jaws took, written by the author of the writer of the screenplay, one of the writers of the screenplay, Carl Gottlieb. But I'd love to sit down in Martha's Vineyard in 1974 with Spielberg and Gottlieb, Peter Benchley, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and Roy Scheider, and just, you know, hang out and talk for hours about whatever it is that they want to talk about.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So that's my answer to that one.
That's a great, great answer. Especially because you knew exactly where you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it has to just be now. It has to be a particular era.
Right. Right.
Well, to go back to now and to go back to relaxing, so what do you read or watch for fun these days? You know, you're immersed in comics and you're immersed mm-hmm. in TV and movies. Like, what relaxes the brain from that then? Are there TV shows that you're really into that are relaxing? Or are there the comics that you've been reading to kind of immerse yourself more in comics?
Yeah. Well, I mean, having not had the background in comics that I think a lot of my contemporaries in the same position have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have conversation with people and they will just, get into the intricacies of, you know, different creators' takes on Captain America and the Green Lantern and Batman. And I'm like, I don't have that encyclopedic knowledge of these characters, because when I was 15 or 16 years old, I was watching movies and just constantly, you know, this was also the era of when I was growing up, it was really the beginning of the home video world.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very distinctly getting our first VCR, and I actually worked in a video store. So I just watched an endless amount of movies during that. So I missed out, I think, on a lot of the sort of shared comic book experience that a lot of people that I've met since have.
Yeah, right. And in the comic book world, it's like, it seems like if you don't have that lexicon, that like encyclopedia to pull from, the conversation, and it's not all creators, but I think creators and fans, there's a majority of it's like, it's almost the shorthand for conversation in comics.
Yeah, no, I have found myself absolutely floundering in conversations with some of these people.
Well, I've read a lot of comics and I find myself floundering all the time.
I was not allowed to read comics as, in my sort of, 10, 12, 13. My mom was very anti-comic books, with the exception of, I got to read, like, she wanted me to read Richie Rich and Little Lulu and the Archies, because she read those when she was a kid, so she liked those.
Uh-huh.
But it was like, I was not allowed to watch Speed Racer because it was too violent.
Hmm.
And yet, they took me to see Alien when I was 9. So it's a weird upbringing that I had. But yeah. So in my teenage years, I sort of got to explore comic books more. I was a big Batman fan, probably because the movie had come out or was about to come out. So I was reading as much Batman as I possibly could. And, but I've, when I started this process of, hey, I'm going to be writing a comic book, I need to read as much, as many comics as I can. You know, whenever I embark on a project for film or television, if there's something that's like it, I will watch that, both to, be inspired by it and also make sure I'm not, crossing some boundaries that I shouldn't. So I read I devoured all of the Alan Moore Swamp Things, read all of the Brian K. Vaughan's Why the Last Man and Ex Machina. Recently I've been reading the Darwin Cook Parker books.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely adore those.
That seems like that would be right in your wheelhouse.
So, yeah, it's right in my wheelhouse. Ed Brubaker's Fatale.
Yeah.
Just because I love H.P. Lovecraft and noir, so it's a great blend of that.
Right.
Well,
it seems like Brubaker's stuff too would really appeal to that, that noir and kind of the hard-boiled crime kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I was reading, was it Criminal or I think it was Criminal. I think he mentions being inspired by Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Sure.
And I was just like, oh, I love that film, and that's just a great thing to inspire him, I guess. I felt a kinship, I suppose.
Sure, sure. If I can make a suggestion too, you should check out Sin City, Frank Miller. Very much in that vein as well. So, what about TV or movies like these days? I'm just kind of curious what's on your radar. Sure.
I mean, I watch a lot of television. I will just pop on an old episode of Buffy or Angel or The X-Files if I've got some time and I'm just unwinding.
Mm-hmm.
End of the day. Stuff that's on the air currently, though, I love Justified.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones. I'm a big sort of swords and sorcery of his big Dungeons and Dragons player.
That's curious. I was going to ask you when you said like you weren't allowed to read comic books, but you were allowed to play Dungeons and Dragons though.
Yeah, well, I don't think they actually really understood what Dungeons and Dragons was.
Okay.
and it certainly wasn't. I remember playing with kids whose parents, came from sort of religious backgrounds.
Right. There was that whole movement, especially like in the 80s, like, Dungeons and Dragons was the pathway to Satan.
Exactly. Thanks to Tom Hanks and Mazes and Monsters.
Right.
But, I mean, I remember having like a sit down with one of my friends who was our dungeon master, and his mom was like, well, we can't play any demon characters because my mom won't let me portray them even in the game space. So, But also I've been really digging True Detective.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, so those are the kind of series that I've been more dramas than sitcoms. There's not many sitcoms that maybe I'll watch Family Guy every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I kind of enjoy that. Yeah. Community, obviously. Also because of the Dungeon. In fact, the first Community episode I watched was the Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, that's great.
that's the stuff I like to watch on TV.
May I suggest the you pick up the A-Team box set?
I don't think I could do that.
Okay.
I've watched a couple of episodes. They've been on TV.
Yeah.
I watched the pilot recently.
Oh, really?
It was on Netflix. Wow. So I went back and watched the pilot with the different Dirk Benedict is not in the pilot. It's Harry Hamlin, if I'm not mistaken.
Hmm. Oh, that's right. As yeah. Fans.
And
I haven't watched that in years. I think I have a very nostalgic, memory of it.
It's not great.
It probably isn't.
It's not great. What I distinctly remember and what I take away from the A-Team was that every time a vehicle exploded, it exploded or crashed in exactly the same manner as it went over a ramp
And flipped over. none of those shows really hold up, do they? Like, I think of like Airwolf or something like that. Like,
but I'll tell you what does. And I went back and I never really watched it when I was a kid. I was watching Riptide more than this. I went back and watched Magnum PI, and I had this newfound appreciation for that show.
Oh, really?
When it worked really well, and it was exceptionally well written in an era when there wasn't a lot of really great television.
Right.
At least really well written TV. It wasn't until the late 80s with, you know, probably Hill Street Blues and I guess Saint Elsewhere and L.A. Law that sort of changed the landscape of television.
Wrote. Don't forget Murder, She Wrote.
Well, only the crossovers with Magnum P.I.
Were there?
Yes, there's a Murder, She Wrote crossover and there's a Simon and Simon crossover.
Oh my God, I have to track those down.
Yeah, well, they're on Netflix.
Awesome. Wait,
Murder, She Wrote's on Netflix?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, interview is over. Hey, thanks for being on. We'll talk to you later. I got something to do.
Seriously, this was great, Callan, especially for the rundown of what we need to add to our queues. I appreciate you being accommodating with your schedule since Aaron let us all down by dying from the plague last week.
Yes.
So it's really good to finally get to talk to you more in depth. Do you have any last words for us? Any
words of inspiration?
Last bits of advice or
I don't know if I have any advice. I may not be the person to I'm the wrong make friends with the publisher, because that is how you get a job writing in comics. I feel horrible saying that, because I'm sure there's a bunch of guys out there that are really just killing themselves trying to get their scripts out there. And
it's not what you know, it's who you know.
It kind of is, but I will say that my experiences in, you know, both Hollywood and now comics, I would say that you don't have to have an uncle in the business, or, you know, it's not really about nepotism. And a lot of people, I think, maybe think that, but get a job in the career, in the field that you want to work for. You know, if you want to write for comics, well, go work for a publishing house, go work for, you know, one of these, offshoots like Skybound, or, you know, just get a job, even as a, you know, receptionist, whatever, just get close to that world. And if your stuff is good, you'll, you know, eventually it'll be a long and arduous process. By the way, my process has taken, you know, I came out here to start writing in 1995, and it's not until 2000 and I guess it was probably 2011 when I actually started getting some notice for my writing. So it sometimes takes a while. You just have to have some perseverance, but it doesn't hurt to stay as close to that industry that you're interested in being a part of as much as possible.
And make friends. I mean, seems like a perfectly reasonable, you know, that's like how industry really works. You're not going to get a job just by knowing somebody, but by knowing somebody and having a talent and skill, that seems
how you need to go. It has to be both. You can't just, I mean, believe me, there are a number of opportunities for mediocrity to rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
It would, however, to stay at the top and to actually continue as a working writer or as a working artist or professional, you've got to have the skill set to back it up. But I'm assuming you have that. The next thing is, you know, immersing yourself in that industry, however you can, getting close to whomever you can, and eventually an opportunity may present itself, and that's the chance to, you know, it's like the kid stepping up at the plate and he gets to hit the home run.
Mm-hmm.
To win the team, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining us today on the couch. Hey, thanks to everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop or subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, on comicstherapy.com. We'll talk to you next week. I ordered something, it took a while. This morning something was on my doorstep. What's this I'm holding? Time capsule order, 'cause I'm a